Welcome everybody to the Blue Skies Dronecast, the podcast by UAV Hub. This is a podcast for the UK drone industry, discussing everything from the UK regulations, new drones, and also speaking to you, the people within the drone industry. Presented this week, as always, by Tom and Adam. So welcome along, everyone, to another Blue Skies Dronecast episode. This time, we're going to be talking about a few different subjects. We've got no special guests this week, so we're going to go over a few different regulation changes. So Adam is smiling when I mention that. We're also going to be talking about a bit of confusion with regards to the operator ID and whether you need your own one or a business one, etc., etc. So we'll talk about that in a bit more detail as well. We'll also talk about flying drones or aircraft in the EU as well. Obviously, it's getting towards the summer, so a lot of you might be going on summer holidays, etc. So we'll give you a bit more information. I'm sure you all know it anyway, but we're going to go over it once more just to make sure we're all 100% clear. And then we've got a couple of FAQs to round off the episode as well. So hopefully quite an interesting one. So before we kick off, I'll just say hello to Adam. He is here. So how are you doing, Adam? All right?
Yeah, all good, Tom. How are you?
Yes, very well, thank you. Yeah, we're all good to go, I think. So, yeah, without further ado, let's kick off with the first topic. So this is all to do with quite a recent sort of regulation change, and it's all to do with these CAP documents that we all should know about, hopefully. And they look as though they're starting to slowly die out or disappear. So what I'll do here is kind of hand you over to Adam, and he can give you kind of the background and sort of what's happening and where we're going potentially. We don't know 100%. We're always one step behind the CAA, aren't we, Adam? But we try our best, and hopefully we can give that information over to you. So yeah, what's happening, Adam?
Okay, so just in case you aren't aware, when we say CAPS, we mean something called a civil air publication. These are sort of documents that were in kind of an online repository where you could access certain pieces of information from the CAA, one of them being the Air Navigation Order 2016. So the Air Navigation Order being kind of the primary set of legislation, as it were, for most, if not all, aviation. This was before the implementing regulations came in, but we won't go into the nitty-gritties. No. But yeah, it's where you could find most information. So it used to be that the Air Navigation Order could be found within something called the CAP 393. If you said the CAP 393 to anybody that kind of knew about this, you go, oh yeah, ANO.
Yeah.
Last year, it might have been the year before, I think it was last year, 2021, the CAP 393 disappeared randomly, and then they released the CAP 2038A00, which was the Air Navigation Order 2016. So that threw a bit of a curveball at us. Now, we've just been given another curveball, which happened, it's probably a month, 2 months ago now, maybe. It's probably a couple of months now. But essentially what's happened is the CAP 2038A00 has now gone from the CAP repository. In addition to that, actually, the quite a few other kind of CAPs are going to be going. Now, why is this? So the CAA are restructuring how they show legislation on their website. So rather than it being through a CAP, they will now have a website where you can navigate to certain pieces of legislation based on what you're kind of looking for. I think the idea is that because there's a lot more people who aren't, I suppose, aviators that aren't haven't come from, you know, full-size aviation background, need to be able to find certain pieces of legislation a bit easier, rather than going, well, I need to know what the CAP is. You know, they'll be able to find it based on logically knowing, well, I need to know this, I'll just find it.
Yes.
Or you'll be able to search for it on the website.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the web, we'll put a link for the website into the podcast description, so if you do want to find it, we'll put a link in there. And essentially what happens now is, if you want to find the Air Navigation Order 2016, you go to this website, you navigate to it, and now there's a PDF, which was pretty much looked exactly the same as what the CAPs did, but it's not called a CAP anymore. It just says the Air Navigation Order 2016 with a bit of extra stuff on the end. But it's really interesting now. So you download the PDF, and you can now look at the last amendment to that piece of legislation. So for the Air Navigation Order 2016, as of shooting this today, so the today's date is the 31st of May, so 2022. So if you listen to this, you're obviously in the future, this could be different. But as of today, if you looked at the ANO 2016 on the website, it says on the first page that the ANO was last amended on the 13th of April 2022. And then to the right-hand side of that, there's a hyperlink, and it tells you that it was amended by the Air Navigation Brackets Amendment Order 2022. Like I said, there's a link that then takes you through to the government website, legislation website, and you can actually then read what that amendment was. So it's, I think it's a lot more straightforward now, rather than you reading caps and then other cap. You've got to then find another cap which sort of supersedes or amends that cap.
Yeah.
The idea is that everything's kind of incorporated into one document, so it's easy to find, and it's going to make things a lot easier to update your operations manual, because whereas before you had, you know, lately there was the obviously the CAP 2038A00, then you had the CAP 2013 as well. Now you don't need those or both of those now, you just need the ANO 2016. You don't reference a version number because there's no version numbers, you just reference the date that it was last amended.
That's right. And the good thing is, I think, from that document, from when I've looked at it, the date is right at the beginning as well in red. So it's like really obvious sort of when it's been amended and what's been changed and stuff like that. So hopefully it should be a little bit easier to kind of reference or look at in the future as well, shouldn't it, Adam?
That's it. I think the idea, let's say, is to make sure that you're always aware of what the latest amendment is. Like I say, whereas before you just had to be aware that, oh, there had been a new cap had been put out, which then amended another cap, which could get confusing. You know, it was, that's where, you know, for ourselves as well, you know, sometimes we were only notified when we saw somebody on a forum had said, oh, there's been a new cap release. We're like, oh, right, we better have a look at that. You know, the CA Skywise doesn't always let you know that there's been a change. Whereas I think if you potentially, you know, set yourself a, you know, a date in your diary once a month, have a quick look at the link and go, has this changed? Nope, there's been no changes. Great. I'll just abide by whatever the previous sets of regulations were. If there has been a change to the date, it's like, right, okay, I need to find out what these amendments are. Click the link. That sends you through to the amendment, and you can read through the amendment. So it's all nice and neat.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels, I think it feels better. I think as we move along and move forward, I think it'll get more kind of easier to navigate and a bit more a bit more normal, I suppose, is the word maybe. But obviously it hasn't been 100% smooth sailing and a perfect transition. There has been a few little errors, and I think one of them was a date that was actually in the future, wasn't it, which was awkward for the CAA. Was that right?
It still is. So again, as of today, 31st of May, I checked it this morning. If you look at the implementing regulation, so the 2019-947 regulations, you'll then see that it says that it was last amended on the 20th of November 2022, which again, as I've said earlier, today's date is the 31st of May 2022. It can't be amended in the future. Well, can't be amended now. There is that error there. If you did click through to the amendment, you will then see that actually it was amended on the 20th of November 2021. So that's the date you should be referencing. So it's one of those, out as much as you kind of want to say, you know, that's the date you need to be using, you still need to double check that the document is right. Because the document that's on the CA's website isn't the government website, so click through to the government legislation to just double check the dates. There is still some human error in there. It shouldn't happen, I would say. That is quite a big boo-boo, especially as it is a, you know, it's been, I think it's been created by lawyers as well, that's been, you know, put these documents together for the CAA. So we did notify them about a week ago now to that this was an error, because we were getting operations manuals bounced back to us saying, oh, the date you've referenced is the wrong date. It should be the 20th of November 2022. We were like, no, no.
Hang on.
You're wrong. It's this date. So the CA are aware of that. And I think they will forgive if somebody did put 2022. They'll just be like, oh, can you just change it to 2021 as an advisory, is what I should hope.
Yeah, they have recognised that now, haven't they, which is good. So, yeah.
Yeah, so they have been notified, but just be aware of that. If something looks off on these documents, just double check it, follow it through, because it's still could be wrong.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly right. Yeah, and what we might do, I'll make a note as well, is we've got a website page, actually, that at the moment, as of, again, as we always say, 31st of May 2022, it sort of lists the documents that are probably the most important ones that you want to know about and also have them in your ops manual as well. So it's kind of good because we try and keep that up to date now as best we can. So if you're ever confused about what you should be looking at, what you shouldn't be, then whatever's listed on that page is relevant for that day, if that makes sense, and moving forward too. So hopefully we can keep that up to date.
And the that website that we will put up and contain some hyperlinks, which will then take you through to the actual the correct part of the CA's website that you need to reference. So again, it's a nice handy kind of website to potentially bookmark, check it once a month, you know, just make sure that your ops manual still reflects the correct legislation, and you can go through to those hyperlinks, have a look at the dates. Again, make sure that they're still correct.
Yeah, that's it. And we've also added a little section underneath that if you do click through to something and they've updated it and we haven't noticed yet, you can actually notify us to then make the change as well. So it's kind of a little community type thing there too, which should hopefully work quite nicely as well. So yeah, if you can help us out, we'll help you out. And that's the way to think of it, I think, is that if we can all work together, we'll hopefully keep that one step ahead. And that's the main thing. So yeah, there we go. So they were quite a big change, but hopefully not too confusing. And like I say, if you follow the links, hopefully everything even should make a bit more sense as well. So what we'll do now is we'll move on to the next topic, and this is all to do with the operator ID. So I think we're all fairly happy with what the operator ID is and what the flyer ID is now. I think it's all fairly straightforward. The biggest issue that we find now is the confusion between if you're a sole trader or if you're working on your own, or if you've got a limited company, you have to have the operator ID reflecting that. And I think people get confused because maybe they've got their operator ID before they'd got their company. And then obviously then now they've got a company and actually the operator ID is just reflecting their name as opposed to the company. And that's what we see coming back from the CAA, Adam. I think now more often than not, actually, it tends to be the operator ID isn't correct and they need to change it. So perhaps, maybe just double check and just go over that for me if you don't mind.
Yes, so as you've kind of said, Tom, so if you're a limited company, you need an organisational ID, operator ID, not an individual one. So if you're a limited company, organisational ID. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need two operator IDs. So for example, if your company has a Mavic 2 Pro, let's say, for example, but you also fly that particular drone for recreational use, you know, you take it out at the weekends and fly it for recreational use, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to have an individual ID for those flights. You can still fly it under the organizational ID because should, heaven forbid, anything go wrong, it will still get back to the correct person. It's still ultimately the remote pilot who is still responsible for that flight, but the ID that's on the aircraft will be able to kind of, you know, get back to whoever's the accountable manager, and then they can say, oh yeah, it was this person that was flying on this date and this time.
So
don't worry about having, you know, two operator IDs. I mean, it's £9 per ID, so it's not the end of the world, but obviously every pound does count.
Yes.
Especially in, you know, today's climate. So like I say, don't worry about having two operator IDs, but if you are a limited company and you currently only have an individual ID, get yourself an organizational operator ID. The CA will start, well, they are starting to reject applications for operational authorizations. There's a bit of a grey area, I think, which we haven't quite clarified, because nobody's kind of said anything about this, but I thought I'd bring it up just in case it does. So if you've got an A2 CFC and you operate as a limited company, it's because the CA only check operational authorizations during sort of the application process. You don't have to apply for an A2 CFC.
No.
Nobody is checking whether you've got the correct, I put in quotations, operator ID. So I would probably go down the same principle again, that if you're a limited company flying a drone under an A2 CFC, get an organizational operator ID. If you're just a sole trader or you're just flying for recreational use, just get an individual one and that should be fine.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? So I think it's just knowing the differences between the two and then sort of choosing accordingly. We're not 100% sure yet whether if you've got a personal one, you can then email the CIA and actually make the change over to a company one. I would find that hard to believe because I'm sure the CIA would like another £9 from you when you need to change something. I could be wrong, but we haven't had anyone that's said that they've done that successfully. It's normally they've got another operator ID, essentially. So if anyone's done that, it'd be interesting to know whether it is possible to edit with regards to that side of things. So if the CIA can make a change and not charge you, you know, that would be interesting to know. But at the moment, I would probably say you can't, I would say. So yeah, that's that subject covered. Adam, anything else to add there at all? Or
I think that's it. I mean, if you do want to change it, I think it's the CA registrations page. register-drones.ca.co.uk. There is a contact us page on that website. I think if you go down to the bottom of the website, in the footer, there is a contact us. Yeah. And yeah, there is a thing about making changes. So yeah, if you do need to, you know, change something, just give them a shout. Yeah, there's a phone number, there's an email address, just contact them. And we're finding this actually with flyer IDs. I'm going to actually add this on as well, that your flyer ID should be in under the name that's on your driving license and passport. So for example, if your legal name is Nicholas, for example, your flyer ID shouldn't say Nick, it should say Nicholas. It should be whatever's on your driving license or passport, or your birth certificate for that matter. So yeah, just make sure that your name is correct. We're finding that every time we're kind of getting people coming through the A2CVC or GVC, and we have to check your flyer IDs. We're seeing that quite a lot, and you know, same thing applies. Go to the register-drones.ca.co.uk, contact us, and just let them know. It takes them about 24 hours to make the change. It's super straightforward.
Yeah. That's it, yeah. And if you're still struggling to find it, it's very simple. If you just put in flyer ID, CIA contact, I think that takes you to the page. I've done that a few times, so it's fairly easy to find. And yeah, they reply back pretty quickly as well, which is always nice too. So there we go. So let's move on to the next subject then. So this is all to do with flying drones in the EU. So are you going on holiday this year, Adam? I know you've already been on one. Are you going on another one or not?
I'd like to say yes, but we will see. There's nothing booked.
No, okay, that's it. Yeah, so I might, I should be going to France. I'm probably not going to take a drone. I think I'm going to have a little week off from drones. You know, I do like drones, but also it would be a bit of a busman's holiday, wouldn't it? Anyway, so not applicable to me necessarily, but a lot of you will be going abroad, I imagine. So we need to just double check ourselves and make sure that we are flying safely and legally. So in an ideal world, you'll have done the A2CFC or the GVC, and you know, because again it's supposed to be the new European licensing, we should just be able to travel to any country and fly there. But obviously that doesn't work anymore because of the B word that we're not going to mention. So now effectively the A2CFC and the GVC is really only UK based for our qualification. So if you are going to any other European country, you will need kind of their version of that type of course, depending on obviously what you're doing. So I'll just let Adam explain that a bit more, I think, but that's kind of the gist of it, isn't it, Adam? You can't get away with just doing this course and then go to any European country. You will have to work out where you're going and sort of what you need to do for that specific European country, pretty much.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, it even includes the A1, A3 certificate as well. So, you know, the one where you just get your flyer ID. None of the UK certificates, regardless of what you have, are accepted within the European Union because of, as you said, the big B word. But it doesn't say that you can't fly. It's just that you've got to get the appropriate certificates in an EU country.
Yeah.
So, for example, obviously a lot of people do fly, say, the DJI Mini, let's say, for example, or something like that. The similar rules apply in the EU. Very similar. In fact, practically word for word almost, but the hours have started to deviate, but there are, you know, it is by and large the same. So there is still the open category, there's still the specific category, you've still got the subcategories within the open category. So if you're flying, for example, the DJI Mini, so technically you don't need a flyer ID, but it's still recommended to get that A1, A3 certificate. I would still do that regardless. And if you do want to get the A1, A3 certificate, you can usually do that online from any of the EU kind of aviation authorities, whether you want to do it through the French one, I think the Luxembourg one seems to be quite popular. There's quite a few now that do it in English.
Yes.
Have an English examination, which is really good. So you can do the flyer ID from any EU country. You can usually do that from the comfort of your own home. However, the big thing you need to be aware of is the operator ID. So you do need an operator ID if your aircraft has a camera or if your aircraft is over 250 grams. So most aircraft that you'll fly. The main thing you need to be aware of with the operator ID is you can only register as a non-EU citizen in the first country that you're visiting. So, for example, I visited Corfu in Greece a couple of weeks ago, and it's the first EU country I have visited, obviously, since it's essentially happened. Oh, I said the big B word.
Oh, no. I'll bleep that out, Adam. Don't worry, I'll bleep it out.
Bleep it out. So I visited this. I visited Corfu in Greece a couple of weeks ago. So because it's the first country I have visited, I was supposed to have, if I wanted to fly my drone there, have registered for my operator ID in Greece through the HCAA. Now, I couldn't have kind of circumvented that and registered in France, for example. I couldn't have got my operator ID there because I haven't visited France yet. I've gone straight to Greece. So I should register there. There's a form I have to fill out saying, you know, this is where I'm staying, this is how long I'm here for, and you can get your operator ID from them. That operator ID can then be used in any other EU country, but it's the first country you're visiting that you have to register in. Like I say, if it's Germany, for example, you're visiting, and that's the first place you visited and you haven't got your operator ID, register in Germany. Your flyer ID can be done anywhere. The operator ID is the first EU country that you're visiting, and then it can be used in any other EU country.
I see. So essentially, once you've done it once in the country that you first visited, you're then covered for any other country you go to within Europe after that.
Yes.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, cool. Perfect.
One thing I will make people aware of, though, is still to check the local laws within the country that you're visiting. So even though that each of the EU countries adopted the same set of regulations, they still might have their own set of specific requirements. Again, this is something that was picked up in Greece.
Yeah.
So Greece, very interestingly, we have a lot of people, we see a lot of people in the forums moaning about, oh, it's so restrictive, you can't do this, you can't do that, blah, blah, blah. In Greece, they have a website where you have to log every single flight, regardless of what category you're flying in, whether you're flying a DJI Mini. There's a website you have to flight plan, essentially. You log your flight, you flight plan it, send it to the HCAA, essentially to get it approved.
Wow.
Before you can fly. So you can't just rock up with your Mini and fly off the beach willy-nilly.
No,
you've got
no.
to get approval first for every single flight. So for everyone that kind of says, oh, yeah, there's a lot of restrictions of where you can and can't fly here.
Yeah.
In some of the EU countries, there's actually a lot more stringent. It's based on, it's a safety point of view to make sure that everyone knows what's happening. If you haven't logged those flights, you can get arrested.
Yeah. Oh, I see. God, that sounds a lot more restrictive, actually, doesn't it? But in a way, maybe it's a good thing, maybe, because at least then you know you're doing things properly, and you've had the sort of the okay. So actually, you'd probably get proof back, wouldn't you, from that? And so if you do get stopped, you've got something to show that you've done the correct thing, I think, which is always nice too, which gets rid of the sort of the grey areas that seem to appear sometimes, I think, which is nice too. So that's interesting. Hopefully that subject has now been explained properly. So Adam, anything else to add for there? I'm just trying to check our notes. I think we've almost covered.
I think that's covered. Like I said, the key thing to take away is if you haven't got an operator ID yet from an EU country you visited, if you're going on holiday this summer and you're taking your drone, register with the country you're visiting, not from any other country you've not visited. Yeah. But once you've got your operator ID, you're good then, at least for 12 months.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that makes sense. Brilliant. Okay, great. So moving on then to the final part of this episode, just a couple of FAQs, actually. So we've put our heads together. We've had a chat with Tim as well. He's always on the front line of all the questions. So he's given us a couple as well. And hopefully, again, these might be useful to a few of our listeners as well. So we had a question in, or an inquiry, I guess, really, for people who want to fly rented or hired in drones or aircraft. So that does sort of come up time and time again, actually. And so basically, with regards to your OA, I guess if you're flying a hired-in drone, you need to make sure it's in your operations manual to start with. That's the most important thing. So if you are hiring the same drone quite often, I would say just have it in the ops manual, because it makes more sense than sort of putting it in, taking it out, putting it in, taking it out. So make sure that's been added, first of all. Then obviously you've got to make sure you're insured to fly it as well. So do make sure, if you have to specify aircraft for your insurance company, make sure you add it in, a bit like adding a second car to your car policy, I suppose, really. But if it's just a blanket cover, then again, you might be fine. But obviously definitely check with your insurance company there. And obviously, and Adam will correct me if I'm wrong on this, you need to obviously make sure you've got your own operator ID on that aircraft when you fly it as well. Would that be correct, Adam?
Yeah, a bit of a grey area, I think. Perhaps something we'll want to follow up with is, I would still put my operator ID on. I'd still stick, you know, put a sticker on to say. However, I would argue you potentially don't, as long as you have supplied your flyer ID to the hire company. Because a bit like how obviously a hire car works, obviously you don't put your own number plate on a car.
We did talk about that, didn't we, as well in a previous episode, so that's true. So yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah.
I would put it on anyway, just in case.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's an absolute requirement, because the whoever you've hired it from should have your details. They should have taken your flyer ID to then, if anything ever happened to it, and you know, let's say the authorities contacted the whoever was registered to the operator ID, they would go, okay, it was this pilot, hired it on this date at this time, it was them. They will be able to find you, as it were, if anything to go wrong. But again, nothing can come from put your operator ID on it. Here we belt and braces, but I don't think you do, but as long as it has an operator ID. If it doesn't have an operator ID on the aircraft, it needs one regardless. If it's got one on and it's valid, so again, you could check that as well. You could go on the CS website and check whether the operator ID on the website is you know, registered to whoever you've hired it from.
That's true.
If it is, you should be okay.
That's good.
But yeah, maybe add your own on anyway.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's the thing, you know, always double check as well. You know, if you rent the aircraft, you know, you could mention it. You could say, you know, has it got an operator ID on it, you know, and if it hasn't, like Adam said, put your own on. If it does have one, no harm in having your own one on there. But if you've checked with the hire company already, or you check through the CAA's website to see if it is the correct one and it's, you know, valid and everything, then, you know, it's just sort of, you know, making sure you do your checks before you fly, I think. The same as your sort of your aircraft physical checks as well, I think. So I think that hopefully covers that one. What about the A2? Do they need to do much there? Probably insurance is the big one, I suppose, isn't it, Adam? And then the same again, I guess, with the operator ID.
Yeah, so I mean, in regards to insurance, obviously we're talking about if you're hiring it in for commercial use or something that's not sport or recreational. So yeah, you still need to be insured. Probably best contacting your insurance company about that. That say that, oh, I've hired this aircraft. And again, same thing for the operator ID. If it's got one on, double check it, make sure it is valid and registered to the company. Add yours on if you want. If you want the belt and braces, I would.
Yeah,
it should be the same principles apply.
Yeah, that's it. So fairly straightforward, hopefully. So just to clear that up, just because we do get that question asked a few times, hopefully now that sort of straightens it out a little bit. The last FAQ, again, this sort of rears its head every now and then. I think everyone knows it, but I think some people potentially might push the boundaries depending on who you speak to. So obviously we're not here to sort of segregate sort of people, etc. But what we want to know is kind of what constitutes visual line of sight or VLOS flying. So obviously most people will know that technically we can fly within 500 meters of ourselves, which is actually a pretty big distance realistically. Adam's got his hand up. I think I know what you're going to say.
just clarify, that's with PDRA 01. It's definitely up to 500 meters. In the open category, there's no specific distances set, but it's the rest will still apply.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So, yeah, if there's a distance, then obviously stick to that. But I think more importantly, it is the visual line of sight, because most aircraft, I would say, will go out of visual line of sight before they hit the 500 meter mark, I would say. So obviously, we're not talking about, and I used to say this on the course, it's not, oh, I can just about see the aircraft. It's a speck on the horizon. I've still got visual line of sight. I would argue you don't, because the whole point of visual line of sight is that if you lost your screen video feed, you've obviously got no way of now knowing which way the aircraft is pointing. And if you can look at a spot on the horizon and work out which way it's pointing, brilliant. You know, you're obviously kind of a superhero, I imagine. But most people will still be confused about what's going on. The next thing that you might do is press return to home, which probably will sort out 99% of the problems. But again, if you, for some reason, lose GPS, then obviously that's when it becomes a big problem, because the aircraft will not come back. It'll drift around potentially in ATI mode, or it'll just start to land and you've got no idea where it is going to land. So the whole point of having a visual line of sight is to actually look up at the sky. If all of those things go wrong, you can go, oh, okay, well, that's fine. It's pointing left. I'll turn it round to face away from me and then I can pull back on the stick and it'll start to come back. Obviously, if you can't do that, I would say it's almost game over realistically, because it will come down at some point and you're not sure where. So visual line of sight is all about making sure that you can identify which way the aircraft is pointing if there is an emergency. So that's how I would define it. And obviously the crucial thing is here with no visual aids. So you can't have, you know, a telescope or you can't have binoculars. If you wear glasses, you can use glasses, but you can't have any special glasses like magnifying glasses that you've concocted. And, you know, I don't know if anyone would do that, you know.
put a few lenses, keep putting lenses in front
that's
of
right
it.
There. Like Inspector Gadget or something similar. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, you know, again, it's common sense. You know, if you're trying to circumvent the rules by making this strange pair of glasses that are, you know, are extending your eyesight, then obviously you shouldn't be doing that. So just normal glasses is fine. And also adding stuff to the aircraft is good as well, or fine, to make it more visible. So LEDs are fine. You know, brightly coloured fluorescent tape sometimes works. But a good LED on one side of the aircraft will actually help, because if you rotate the aircraft through 360 degrees, eventually you'll see that flashing light. And you know, oh, okay, that's the back of the aircraft. And so now I would say, yeah, you do have visual line of sight, I would argue. And now you can bring the aircraft back. So I think that's how we would define it, Adam. You agree?
Yeah, yeah. Bang on. I've got really nothing else to add to that.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly right. So again, use your common sense. What we're always trying to do is plan for the worst case scenario. So whenever you take off, expect that you're going to lose the video feed, you're going to lose your GPS, and you're going to have to land. And if you can't see the aircraft properly, then, you know, are you flying safely? That's what we would argue. And obviously, we know the technology is very good these days. You know, DJI, almost their first thing that they talk about is, you know, a 10-kilometer range, which it would do. And, you know, hopefully the regulations will start to catch up with the technology and enable us to fly, you know, further than visual line of sight. And it is happening. It's just slowly kind of progressing, I think, with regards to the technology. So, you know, who knows what can happen in the future, but at the moment, visual line of sight is a visual line of sight. So just making sure that we're all happy with that. And I think now we're hopefully all on the same page as well. So yeah, anything else to go over there, Adam? I think, like you've just mentioned, I probably have covered most of it.
I think that's covered a lot of it. I mean, like, as you've kind of already said, you know, this is for any drone, whether you're looking at the mini, you know, very, very small drones. I mean, it's funny, actually, because you see a lot in the forums, like, oh, yeah, I flew my mini out to 500 metres. And you're like, how the hell did you see a mini out at 500 metres?
That's
unbelievable. And I think it's one of those that it's probably worth you doing. It's something that we've done, or we do on our flight tests, at least some of our examiners do, is where they'll say, okay, send your aircraft out and keep going until you think you're just out of visual line of sight, you know, or, you know, as far as you're comfortable going. And then, you know, but don't look at the screen, keep flying out. And you go, okay, how far do you think you are? And people go, oh, 500 meters. Then they'll look, okay, look down, you know, have a quick look at your screen. How far away are you? And like, oh, 200.
Yeah.
So sometimes you're not as far out as you think you are. It's something that I think it's worth you doing to kind of go, okay, well, I know, if you know that you can still see your aircraft at a certain distance, then obviously keep an eye on that, as on your telemetry of your aircraft, because then you can go, okay, well, I'm at I'm at 120. I know I'm comfortable for another 30 minutes, so after that point, I better stop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's a good thing to do. Just test it out and, you know, see what it is for you, because it is different for different people as well. So, and on the same sort of note, actually, Adam just mentioned instructors. We've got our full sort of instructor crew up and running now, I think, Adam, haven't we? I think we've got seven instructors. So I think the last two were the ones we wanted to get sort of up and running, and they are now. So we've got Scott in Exeter, which is great. And we've also got Aaron in... where is it?
County Durham.
County, that's right, yeah. So up sort of north on the right-hand side of the UK, isn't it? That's right, yeah. So they're all available now to be booked in as well. So, yeah, so if anyone was waiting for that, that has now happened. So we're all good.
If you went to where as well, we've got Toby as well in the Midlands. Wolverhampton, I think.
That's right.
Wolverhampton, yeah. Toby's in Wolverhampton now. Hmm. So just kind of let's kind of have a quick route down, just in case you're wondering where we are. So we're up in Glasgow with Jamie. We've got Aaron in County Durham. Yeah. We then come down again. We've got Chris in Lancashire, Chorley in Lancashire. Come further down, we've then got Toby in Wolverhampton in the Midlands.
Yep.
And then we come a bit further down, we've got Simon in Basingstoke.
Yeah.
And then finally, hopefully I've not missed anybody yet, we've then got Scott in Exeter.
That's it. Well done.
I think that should be...
That was a good memory test, wasn't it?
So there are all our current examiners. Obviously, yeah, we do try our best to get as close to you guys as we can. Yeah. I mean, compared to where we were a few years ago, we used to only have two examiners. In fact, at one point it was only one, but now we have two. Yeah. We're now in seven different locations. We would love to be, you know, an hour from absolutely everybody, but it's not always physically possible, but we're getting close to that now. Yeah, we'd still love somebody in Wales somewhere. We know that Wales is quite a difficult area to try and navigate, especially if you're whether in the north or the south. You know, it's not always someone super close to you. We know that Kent as well, potentially. Missed somebody. Suffolk. We've got Adam and Alex in Suffolk.
How did we do that? That's embarrassing, isn't it?
sorry about that. We would still love, you know, to get as many places as we can still. You know, we know that the far reaches of Scotland, you know, are still untapped up in Aberdeen. But you know, we are doing our best to still kind of recruit more. But yeah, we've covered a lot of places now. Yeah.
I think most people are now probably within a couple of hours, aren't they, of an OE location, which I think is pretty good. Remembering back to when I did mine, that it was a 6-hour drive with a hotel stop halfway through. So you know, yeah, I think everyone's hopefully fairly well catered for. And remember, a lot of the instructors are doing the odd weekend as well, so that should help you out too. So you can have a nice day out in these new locations and treat it a little bit like that, maybe. As well, so so there we go. So I think what we'll do is we'll call that another episode completed, I think, Adam. So just before we finish off, we'll just sign off how we normally do. So don't forget, if you've got any questions, send them into dronecast@uavhub.com. Subscribe if you haven't already. I'm sure most of you are now, but if you haven't clicked that button, just go ahead and do it, and then that means you'll get the podcast straight into your inbox every other Wednesday morning. Review the podcast if you don't mind as well. Obviously, we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and a couple of other ones, Google Podcasts as well, so you should be able to find us very easily. And also tell a friend, like we always say, as well, if you don't mind too. But without anything else to go over, I don't think we've got anything else to cover. That's pretty much it. So thanks again, Adam. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Cheers, Tom. I will be... we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, we will indeed. That's it. Yeah, we should have hopefully a good interview with the two-part series, actually, with the Black Belt Barrister, shouldn't we? I think that's what we've got lined up.
Yeah, really good, really, really good interview. I think it'll be really useful for a lot of people. We cover quite a few different subjects, a lot about sort of land users' permission and privacy. Mm. We cover quite in depth. I think some people will be very surprised about what you can and can't do. We talk about bylaws as well and a few other things in regards to that, and yeah, it's a bit of an eye-opener, I think, for people.
Yeah we were surprised, I think, with some of the stuff, in a good way as well, which is always nice. It's nice to hear from someone who kind of definitely knows as much as you can know. He still says there are some grey areas, which is nice to know, because we say that too, but he's pretty much got his finger on the pulse with regards to, kind of where the situation is at the moment with all of these subjects. So definitely tune in a couple of weeks. It's definitely worth it. And yeah, like I say, it's two episodes because he had a lot to say, which was always nice too. So,
and he's somebody that's on your side. You know, this isn't about him saying, this is the law. This is about him saying, well, actually, in a court of law, this could happen, but this is what you could argue in your favour is kind of, I suppose, his approach. He's all for the consumer, all for you, about giving that advice. So it's really good. Worth checking him out if you haven't done so already, Black Belt Barrister on YouTube. Yeah, but we will be speaking to him, like I say, two-parter over the next two episodes.
Yeah, that's it. Brilliant. Okay, so we'll look forward to that anyway. So, thanks again, everyone, for listening. And, we'll see you soon, hopefully. Fly safe and blue skies, everyone.